Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started. Yay. All right. So I know there's still a bunch of you coming in, signing in, grabbing food, but we're going to just quiet down and get right to it. So my name is Betty Jean. I'm on staff for the Catalyst Project, and I just want to welcome you all. We're so happy to have so many of you here today, and I hope that while you're here, you'll grab some food, grab some drink. The restrooms are at this part of the building, and we're just so happy to have you all with us. So how many of you are familiar with Catalyst Project? I know we're all about. All right, a good crew of you. So Catalyst Project, for those of you who aren't familiar, we are a center for political education and movement building. We work strategically to develop white anti-racist leadership in predominantly white sectors of left social movements, with the overall goal to build multiracial movements for justice and liberation of all people. So a big part of our strategy is developing activists and leaders and organizers to strengthen organizations and campaigns and alliances. And the Ann Braden program is one big part of that strategy. But before we hear from the panelists about their understanding of anti-racist organizing strategy, I want to tell you a little bit about how we understand that term at Catalyst. So to describe our work, we at Catalyst Project use the shorthand white anti-racist organizing. But what does that mean? So when we say white, we are talking about the historical and institutional development of white supremacy and capitalism in the United States, which results in my now being a white person. As a white person, I have material, cultural, and psychological privilege in this country. Now, we know that white is not a biological reality, but rather it's a category of power. The United States was created as a white nation for white citizens. The recent example of the failure of our federal government to respond effectively to Hurricane Katrina demonstrates this enduring reality to the world. So when we talk about white, we're not talking about who I am as an individual person, but as a social position within this country. My relationship to the state and to the economy dictates a lot about who I am, and white supremacy is internalized in me as a white person. So by anti-racist, we mean talking with white people about white privilege and white supremacy as a gateway to talking about revolutionary politics in general, specifically anti-imperialism. And by this, we mean challenging the role of the United States in the world, and how white supremacy is a central part of the relationship between the U.S. ruling class and the global South, as well as the relationship between the U.S. and communities of color in our country. By revolutionary politics, we are talking about collective liberation, committed to the liberation of all people from all forms of oppression. And we see this as a long-term political commitment that guides our work, shapes our strategy, and helps us think creatively about our vision for the world. We challenge internalized white supremacy and how individualism limits us, particularly white activists, in developing collective action and collective organizing. For myself, as a white person, I see how white privilege distorts my understanding of history and my relationship to it. White privilege negatively impacts my relationship to oppressed peoples in the United States and around the world. White privilege locks down my imagination and narrows my understanding of freedom to that of a scarce commodity that only a few of us could access. But anti-racism is a process of liberation. It's a process of believing that liberation is abundant and that it's necessary for the physical and emotional well-being of all people. White supremacy leads me to believe that only certain people can have access to power and that those certain people look like me. Anti-racism is a commitment to changing that worldview and changing the conditions of the society we live in. So when we say anti-racist, we're talking both about the work to change those conditions and the process of political development that white people must go through to actually believe that that kind of world and that kind of collective liberation is possible. That's what we mean by anti-racist. And by organizing, We mean breaking the solidarity of white people to the ruling class and the status quo, breaking off any and all sections of the white community that we, as white anti-racists, can. History has demonstrated that certain parts of white communities are more likely to break off based on their own experiences of oppression and their own struggles for justice. People who are women, working class, queer, transgender or gender variant, disabled and or Jewish have historically been anti-racist leaders in this country. We believe that powerful, dynamic movements can and will come from these communities, and that the leadership from white people who experience oppression is a key part to building multiracial movements for collective liberation. We believe in organizing white communities for social justice, and that those struggles need to actively challenge white supremacy. The goal, Catalyst's goal for white anti-racist organizing, is to build active solidarity with liberation movements coming out of communities of color, both in the United States and around the world. So in addition to the Anne Braden program, which today's session is part of, we also have two other programs that I briefly want to mention. We have a New Orleans Solidarity Program, which supports organizers of color and white anti-racists in the long-term just reconstruction of New Orleans. We also have a National Anti-War Program, which supports veterans, conscientious objectors, and other war resistors in both the United States and the Middle East to work toward a world free from militarism, knowing both that war harms all of us, but that it particularly targets people of color, both abroad and at home. So, you all are here as part of the Anne Braden Program, which is one of the ways that we develop white anti-racist leadership. Today, this is session 13 in a 4.5-month program, and in addition to these kinds of workshops, our participants also meet one-on-one with a mentor and have volunteer placements with economic and racial justice organizations around the Bay Area. So this is one of our three open sessions where we invite the participants to bring their friends and family and colleagues as a way to share their experience with other people in their lives. It's also an opportunity for Catalyst to bring together people in our wider community to look at these issues together. And before we continue, we are going to have what's a regular part of our sessions, which is participants doing some cultural sharing. So Zee and Alex, who are our cultural sharing coordinators, are going to introduce that piece of the program.
How's everybody doing? Who's really excited about this panel that's about to happen? So, like Betty Jean touched on here, in addition to meeting every Sunday, Anne Braden participants have several opportunities for engagement with different communities. Each program participant is placed, like Betty Jean said, as a volunteer at local youth and people of color-led organizations. And some examples are POWER, California Coalition of Women Prisoners, La Raza Centro Legal, PODER, Californians for Justice, Arab Resource and Organizing Center, Coalition on Homelessness, All of Us or None, Critical Resistance, Just Cause, and that's just some of them. Also, each participant is assigned a mentor with whom they can meet at least three times during the program. So along with fundraising commitments, Catalyst hosted events and discussions and countless participant-led and hosted discussion and strategy sessions. Participants have an opportunity to share, discover, or reconnect with and share part of their culture that has significance to them and that they bring to the group. Z's going to say a little bit more about that.
So how does everybody feel about that? White people reclaiming their roots and creating a culture based on liberation and not rooted in white supremacy and cultural appropriation? All right. So we're going to have two people sharing a couple of poems about that work that they're doing. And first we're going to have Kendra come up to the microphone. So please make lots of noise, give lots of love to Kendra.
So I'm going to read a piece that I wrote about my time on the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona. And I was actually debating between reading this piece because I was wrangling with how it actually connected with my culture. And so I want this to be part of a conversation, whether it, you know, connects with like a Jewish culture of questioning, whether it connects with a culture of having U.S. citizenship,
in which I don't question my citizenship, but just live my whole life without thinking that I could be deported at some point. So it's a conversation, so let me know what you think. Oh, and this is specifically about, I went to something called Operation Streamline, which was started during Bush number 2's administration, in which they are now having mass trials for 70 people who are migrating at a time. Instead of taking people to the Mexican side of the border and dropping them off, they're now having these mass trials, so people's names get in sort of the US books, and then they start serving jail time for crossing. Okay. 70 men and women in shackles, 140 chained hands attached to chain waists, chained ankles shuffling with a heavy, consistent clank. This is the first time I've seen chained people before. One judge, how do you plead? 8 defense lawyers, guilty, Your Honor. 70 men and women in shackles, guilty, culpado. One family cries on the bench in front of me, tears streaming down their fierce faces as their loved one is brought out. One bailiff blocks all conversation, preventing a proper goodbye. One judge admonishes 70 men and women in shackles for crossing one border. One lawyer intones, my client has a child and a wife in America, he is going to cross again. One judge replies, don't come here and start a family. Have a family in your own country. May his words get caught in his throat. For a moment, may he not breathe. Just for a moment, may he understand. Let him travel to the Sonora Desert in August, physically unable to carry enough water to cross. Let his thirst have a conversation with the lawyers at the NAFTA negotiation table who knew full well Mexican jobs would be lost. The judge says, don't start a family, and one man in shackles responds in English, I think there's been a mistake. I've been here since I was 8. Mexico is not my home. The lawyers say they are impotent since the Bush administration. The judge says he is not an immigration attorney. What do we say, those of us with US passports, invisibly shielding us against 110-degree Arizona heat? I can hike in the desert, get scraped up, and pretend I know. Or I can pretend I wasn't just there in the courtroom, act as if I haven't been unalterably changed by 70 shackled human beings. My stomach isn't big enough to eat all this up. I want to vomit, piss it out, which the man who found us in the desert can't do because he's been drinking water out of puddles after 20 years living in North Carolina. He chose to cross during monsoon season because he knew puddles would help him survive. The family crying in the courtroom clutches tightly at their Bible. Oh Lord, why do terrible things happen to people? Not good people, none of us are good, and we don't need to be made stronger like this. How do I talk about these things? How do I write them down? How can I tell you? 70 men and women in shackles. Thank you.
Okay, and next we have Ayla to read a poem. Please give it up for Ayla.
Is this one on too? Oh, okay. I guess it is. Okay, good. So I like to think that my poetry about Palestine, which is what this is about, is rooted in a possible potential Jewish culture that is not just a Jewish culture that is anti-Zionist and that challenges the Israeli occupation as a part of Jewish culture. I also strive to write poetry that specifically relates to movements. And so this poem is rooted in the movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, which you will hear more about in the poem. It's called What We Turn To. Little by little, we whittle away at the groundwork they laid long before 1948. A state signified by a star that belongs to the name of my father, but David grew up to be just another Goliath, fought now with naught but rock and sling, and I have no reason to cling to a symbol I know now means genocide, occupation, apartheid. Colonization means bodies bleeding, burning, blindfolded behind checkpoint gates, buildings broken, collapse upon themselves like a mourning mother's heart. Everything falls apart. So, little by little, we whittle away their foundation with every device at our disposal, our voices, consumer choices, the people, rhythm, color. Hope is the hatchet with which we dream, with which we act, with which we breathe. We wish we could rip their violent ideologies to shreds. Instead, we whittle, little by little, with nonviolent tactics, not because violent resistance is wrong, but because their weapons are stronger only if we think in terms of rockets against bombs. And most of us can't throw rocks that far anyway, so I say, what if we think in terms of truth against lies? I know it's been said before, but we have justice on our side, and this is the weapon we turn to, the one with which we turn the tide, break open and expose the idea that created a state of fear, a state of war. This is the weapon we turn to, justice. And what if we hurl the brutality of their reality back at them out the tips of our pens? What then? What if we paint their apartheid wall with pictures depicting six-year-old girls too young to be corpses, whose bodies are buried under rubble, under sand, next to someone else's missing hand and feet? Will the wall crumble then under the weight of her mother's grief? What if we could see dance as a dialect of grounded dreams? Because movement is more than a protest, it's a promise of change one day. What if we chain ourselves in front of every Israeli consulate every day in every city, from New York to the Bay, until they cave to our demands? Free Palestine, end the occupation, the right of refugees to return. What if we chained ourselves there till they learned? What if here in the belly of one of the beasts we decided to boycott the other racist colonial apartheid state? Boycott because this is global capitalism, a system where beside our hunger for justice sits a global hunger. For justice, but also for food, for truth and revolution, but also for water and a roof. So we boycott because we too can use our currency to turn the tide. And because Motorola, L'Oreal, Lev Levaya, Victoria's Secret, and Jaffa Oranges all have one thing in common, apartheid. So maybe the most direct action is to whittle away where it hurts. What if we were to assert that past trauma does not allow a people to perpetuate lies or perpetrate genocide, and as long as they ride the current of injustice, they should know this, they're wrong, and the world's on the other side? What if we all do everything we can? Yes, we can. What if here in the US we just listen? I know we said we won't be silent, and we shouldn't, but just be quiet for a moment and listen. Hear the smoke of oppression emanate from city sidewalks and sirens. Hear, like smog, like steam out of the gutter, just listen to the lack of our innocence. Just listen to what isn't, and wonder what justice sounds like. Just listen to the stories. Because somewhere in the voices between rage and grief, perhaps there is a glimmer. A sliver of hope in a sad song written in a minor key of mourning can be transposed into a key of return, and somewhere a yearning phoenix is ready to burn. Tired of waiting for another round of rubble to rise up from, she resolves to reshape her feathers into fire right now, and come straight out the barrel of their guns. Unsuspecting soldiers expected bullets are surprised to see there are none. Only birds, only survival, only flying, flying free. Yes, we can. Even when the scent of dead and burning bodies is so strong we can taste it overseas. Even when they're crying blood and bleeding fear and tears are easier to come by than fresh water, because there is too much death and the Dead Sea has seen too much, and she is still waiting to be touched by those still living, and little by little we whittle, and little by little we build. And little by little we live until little by little adds up.
Okay, so how's everybody feeling? Good? Are you ready to hear some phenomenal panelists? learn some deep lessons about organizing strategy? Yeah? So thank you to Kendra and Ayla for sharing with us, getting up in front of the room. And I think their stories reground us in the real life and death consequences of white supremacy and racism. And so to move us into thinking about how do we counter these huge systems of oppression, and what is it that we can do on the ground to really bring people together to fight for an alternative way of being, a way of living, and challenge institutional systems that are trying to keep us all down in different ways. So today we are going to hear from four amazing organizers who are going to share with us about organizing strategy. What is it that guides the work that they do, and how do they think about making both changes on a local level here in Oakland and San Francisco, on a national and international level? What are the pieces that we can do here and now to build with people across the country? And Gender Justice, former director of the Women of Color Resource Center, also a founder of that. So. We have Carla Wallace, who's joining us from Louisville, Kentucky, who was a founder of the Fairness Campaign, and also is part of the Kentucky Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Also was a mentee of Ann Braden, which is exciting. And Don Phillips, who is the organizing director of Just Cause Oakland, which many of you all know, alongside all these amazing organizations. So we're going to hear from the panelists, are each going to take some time to share some lessons with us, and then we will have some time for some question and answer discussion at the end. So Linda, would you like to kick us off?
Hi. It's really good to be here today, and it's always good on a really sunny, fabulous day to find 100 and some people inside talking about racism when they could be outside playing. So congratulations to all of you for being here. I'm a little bit under the weather. I have been for the past couple of days, so I'm just going to make a few comments, put them out there for you all to think about, not really do a formal presentation, but I hope put a few things out there on the table that will spark your thinking. So the first thing I want to talk about, first thing I want to make reference to is the relationship between anti-racist struggle and democracy, which you may have been talking about in your in all the training that you've been doing, and also the relationship between your revolutionary politics and democracy. And encourage you to really do some thinking about that. Because the revolutionary politics and the notion or the certainty that this country needs a extremely deep and thoroughgoing transformation of all sorts of social and economic relations and in terms of its relationship to the rest of the world is certainly the case. But there are a couple of things to note about how the anti-racist struggle has unfolded here in the U.S. What the, in my view anyway, the anti-racist struggle has been about pushing the boundaries of democracy. Although there have been many, many, many revolutionaries involved, in the anti-racist struggle, all the way along the way. It's not true that the core of the politics of the anti-racist movement have necessarily been revolutionary at various stages of its development. The anti-racist movement really has been about, in many cases, what is distorting democracy, small d democracy, what are the profound distortions of democracy that that racism is grounded in, and how is it that anti-racist movement can remove those distortions and expand democracy. And the interests, not only of people of color, but of white folks in the anti-racist struggle has been in part a deep moral commitment to equality, but it at the same time it's been a deep commitment to expanding democracy and to understanding the ways in which this country can be made better even this side of revolution. So I want to put that out there because I think it's an important piece to think about. So from my point of view, also just looking now at the black-white axis of anti-racist movement, and I see you have a timeline over there, and I didn't see it when I came in, so I really want to go back and take a look at the timeline of white supremacy and and anti-racist resistance. But I want to just go long curve timeline. And in my view, the long curve timeline is pretty simple. There's the struggle against slavery that takes us from the 17th century up until 1863. And that struggle against slavery has took many, many different forms, including slave rebellions, including all kinds of political struggle. So that's one stage. So, and that stage, again, is a struggle for democracy in the context of the U.S. In other words, the struggle to extend basic citizenship rights, voting rights, the right not to be property, to the enslaved, all right? So it's a revolution in one sense, but it's not a revolution in capital relations. That's the first stage. The second stage, which runs from 1863 to 1964 or so, or the 1950s and 1960s, is the struggle against segregation, which again is essentially a struggle to extend basic democratic rights to a portion of the population that had been denied basic democratic rights. And now we're in a post-civil rights era. I'm sure it'll be called something else long way down the road. People will look back. It will not be called the post-civil rights era. It will be called something else. But for now, let's just call it the post-civil rights era. And the post-civil rights era poses a different set of issues and problems than the prior stages of anti-racist struggle. And obviously, in all of these struggles, in both of those prior phases, while people of color have been central to defining how their movement would evolve, what main strategies could and should be taken up and could and would be effective, who the targets of those strategies were, white folks have been involved and played leading roles in those two phases. The post-civil rights era is in some ways a little bit, or complicated in different ways. and poses different challenges. Partly because the legitimacy of the struggle against racism has been undermined by the notion that once legal segregation was done with, then the whole issue was finished with. And the right wing, and this is also where the issue of the struggle for democracy comes up, the right wing has been, I would say, enormously successful in delegitimizing conversation about race. And the civil rights era, the post-civil rights era, therefore, is characterized by very divergent perceptions. I'm going to stay on the black-white axis for a while, between white folks and black folks about whether or not racism even continues to exist. So there are all kinds of polls that have been done that will show that, you know, black folks feel like, well, there's a lot of stuff that's still operative from our point of view, and white folks are like, basically, we're tired of the conversation, and what's the problem? So the right wing has been very skillful and continues to be very skillful in engaging in essentially racist dialogue while pretending that they're not engaging in racist dialogue. In other words, in something that I and others call dog whistle racism, there's the capacity of, you know, the Glenn Becks of the world to trigger essentially racist sentiments among white folks, to mobilize essentially racist sentiments among white folks without using any of the terminology of race. They're very good at it. And it characterizes how all of this kind of Tea Party, health forum, let's get the resentful white folks mobilized. Their capacity to do that without using the language of race, I think, is one of the main challenges of this period. And how to create space for the dialogue about the ongoing existence, presence, influence of racism. Because it becomes a little bit more difficult to actually engage in the struggle when you can't even have the dialogue. And that dialogue has become more complicated then with the kind of post-racial, we got Obama thing going on. So the notion that, the explicit notion now named that we live in a post-racial post-racial America. So I think these are some of the challenges of the post-civil rights era. I guess I would say just a couple more things on this, and that is, in that sort of long curves of anti-racist struggle, there are also ebbs and flows, and what I have come to think of in the evolutionary science, there's something called punctuated equilibrium, meaning you kind of go along like this for a while, and then something more or less dramatic happens, and then you go along again. For me, there's an analogy to that for how democratic, anti-racist, anti-war struggle evolves in the U.S., meaning that there are long periods, and we're in one of them now, where there's kind of an ebb in struggle, so there are not thousands of people out in the street, millions are not mobilized, it's not on the minds of millions, being engaged in struggle. People like yourselves are a little bit of an oddity. not in a bad way, but but it's not the case that millions of people are in motion. And then there comes a period when millions of people are in motion. And that period may last, you know, I don't know, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, where there's a huge upsurge in consciousness. Consciousness changes dramatically. Consciousness of social relations in the U.S. changes dramatically. And people's willingness to kind of get out there and fight changes dramatically. So I say this because it's important to know what period you're in. Because for many of you in this room, you're not old enough to have experienced a period when there was a big upsurge in a social movement. So I say that to say that there will be again in your lifetimes. There will be again an upsurge in social movement wherein there's dramatic change in consciousness, anti-racist consciousness, and consciousness around, because the other significant and important relationship is that consciousness around racism and the relationship between race and democracy and race and foreign policy also impacts obviously, other people's thinking about other forms of oppression and people's willingness to move in relationship to other forms of oppression. So just to say that that will come again in your lifetimes. And the work that you're doing now in a period when of relative ebb, when millions are not out marching, is extremely important because it's work that it is work that lays the groundwork and starts to build the leadership for a period when our movement for democracy and revolution will be in a different space than it is today. Which is to say that I really appreciate the work that you're doing. It's really important work. It's extraordinarily important to figure out how to engage in that dialogue with white folks, how to ensure that, or do the best you can to ensure that those, that way of being triggered by the right that is based in race and based in racism, that there's an alternative dialogue to that. It's important not just for the anti-racist struggle, it's really important for baseline democracy in the country. It's important for moving the country forward in a positive direction, that tendency to be pulled to the right on the basis of race, which is a very powerful tendency in the white population to be drawn to the right based on their racial interest, that there be a counter to that and a consistent counter to that and a counter to it from people that they can see and recognize and hear as coming from a similar experience, life experience. All right, that's what I'll say for now. Thank you.
I'm going to say the same thing I said last year, so Linda, you can have the rest of my 15 minutes. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Dawn Phillips, and I'm one of the organizers at Just Cause Oakland. Linda, thank you, really. I think you know someone's really good when you're like, you have prepared notes, and then you listen to the speaker prior to you, and it's like, well, start over. I wanted to also, like Linda, give a little bit of a disclaimer. I'm not feeling the best today either. I'm a little tired and feel like I'm fighting something. So I originally planned to probably read from my notes more than I usually would. But Linda's given me inspiration, so we'll see what happens. But if it sounds like I'm reading a little bit, please excuse me, because I probably am. So originally, it wasn't really my plan to talk about the work that I do at Just Cause. The Ingrid and the folks at Catalyst had asked me to kind of address the question of strategy in kind of left mass-based community organizing, which is kind of the sector and the work that I do. But I actually want to talk a little bit about what Just Cause is and the project of Just Cause for a second, because I think the points that Linda made are really, really important and really, really critical. And everything that Linda said actually is some of the core foundational thinking, that the core foundational assessment that Linda put out is really kind of in some ways what formulates this project that you know I've been in and the other folks in my organization have been doing for about a decade now. We've been trying to think this stuff through. So what we're trying to do at Just Cause, and I think folks know a little bit about it, I'll just put out some of the basics. Just Cause is a local here in Oakland housing rights organization, primarily housing and civil rights. We started in a very embryonic form around the attempt to pass a local tenant protection ordinance that would basically prevent people from kind of, or it would severely limit the ability of landlords to evict tenants, basically, right? That's what it did. It shrunk down to just three or four what we call just and reasonable reasons why people could be evicted. And from that point, to what we're trying to do with the project right now, I think is some of the key points that Linda was addressing. So firstly, the work is trying to be and think about how to be multiracial and anti-racist. And right now, we're actually in the middle of a merger process with a sister organization in San Francisco called St. Peter's Housing Committee that organizes primarily Latino folks. Here at Just Cause, we organize primarily working class African American folks, and their base is primarily Latino immigrants. And there's really trying to move what has been two largely monoracial working class bases of color together to, within a single organizational form, really think about how would you deeply engage around some of what is this kind of systemic divisions and the kind of institutional stuff that has been introduced between these two communities, that kind of really keeps people, both divided and actually, actively acting and working against each other's interests and in large part against their own interests at the same time. So it's trying to build a project that's multiracial in an era where Linda, I think, really, really accurately summed it up. I mean, you go into working class communities, and it's really not a popular line to discuss race and racism. Most working class communities of color have really agreed with the hegemonic view that, in fact, race is done, that's what the civil rights era was for. Those were the successes, and that was the achievements of the work of Dr. King and many of the civil rights leaders that folks in working class communities of color really do look to and deeply they understand they benefited from it, but really there's a sense that folks want to be over that. They do want to talk about something else. The second component of the project is that it is thinking about how we actually engage around an anti-capitalist politic as well as an anti-racist politic within communities of color, which is also a fairly challenging and difficult thing to do because, we are doing that from a context of being within the United States, right? So then if you have an international understanding, and if you have a understanding of imperialism and how it's functioning globally, you understand that even the working class of this country, the working class communities of color, are definitely benefiting from imperialism and the kind of global capital, or the organization of global capital, you know, internationally. So the fact that folks here have access to unlimited number of pairs of Nikes that you could possibly want actually do materially change people's relationship to the question of like how invested are they in capitalism. So it's there is a real need both to be anti-racist and anti-capitalist. And then, you know, by that effect, you know, the third component of what we're trying to do is we're trying to imagine how you then, you know, how you then do that in terms of situating the conditions, situating the interests of working class communities of color here in this country in a kind of global strategy, in terms of global struggle, in terms of global movement, right? Because the fact is that if we were to just examine these questions from a perspective of looking at communities of color within this country, then in fact, there are many fights, there are many potential outcomes for your fights and struggles that happen here that actually end up hurting, you know, tremendously the interests and the lives and material conditions of people in other places. So, you know, there was a period where I was doing environmental justice organizing here in Oakland, and one of the things that we were organizing around was, for example, a medical waste incinerator in the Fruitvale community, which is a predominantly Latino immigrant community. And, you know, the company was telling the community that in order for them to relocate, they were going to do two things. They were either going to shut down, and there was going to be a loss of several hundred jobs. Most of those jobs, you know, union jobs, working class folks, some living in the community and some not, or that the company was going to relocate to Latin America, right? Somewhere. So the victory of the Fruitvale community would have been the loss, or the, you know, the in some ways the step backwards for some community somewhere else, and you know, who knows where they would have gone, Bolivia, wherever, right? So thinking about these things, I think that those are some of the kinds of things in terms of the work that we're doing, and in terms of what we're trying to think through. These the points that Linda raised have some very direct and practical applications to daily on the ground organizing. The slow work of doing kind of base building and community organizing work in a protracted period of ebb for me. I mean, I also have never seen the upshoot. So I'm waiting, Linda. I'm ready. Tell me when it's coming, cause I got my marching shoes on. So I think so from there, want to try to get a little bit more into some of what I prepared to talk about. I think that for most of us, for myself certainly, it's really hard and confusing to think about strategy. And I think why strategy is so hard for me is that we, you know, for me, I started doing this work. The reality is that at best, there was a, you know, there was a kind of a lack of visible, clear left organization in this country. There's a lack of visible and clear left movement and left energy in some ways in the country. And the places where, if you study your movement history, where movement and left strategy comes from, when I was coming up, I was looking in the closet, I was looking at the marches, I was looking in the organizations. I didn't know, and I didn't recognize, I didn't see anything that in my mind really, you know, resembled that. There are elders and people doing a lot of thinking and talking about how to address that, but I think the reality is for me, I came up in this work during a period where those things were really not that visible, right? And so these comments I'm going to share largely come from my experience, and they're just going to be points because at this point I have 3 minutes. So firstly, I want to share, I think that you can't build a movement without strategy. Some of what I think our work has been about is that in my experience, left mass-based organizing, the kind of work that I do, has an important relationship to strategy, and that's what I'll address. There are other parts of how to build strategy, but that's what I know. Thirdly, we'll see if we get to the question of anti-racist whites in that building that movement and doing that left mass-based work. So the first point I want to make is that movement building requires and needs both the most accurate assessment of the existing current conditions, as well as a deep understanding of the movements and movement analysis that has come before. Secondly, it has to be built on real clear vision, strategy, and tactics. Each of these words mean things in themselves, and so you could then imagine one day of talking about just even one of those. And lastly, something that I think we're also not very good at is thinking about scale. Which last year, Linda, you talked a lot more about scale. The last time the elections were right around the corner or something like that, and you addressed the question of scale a lot more. The mass in mass movement, in my understanding, you know, isn't hundreds or thousands even. I mean, I think we have to think as movement people, as revolutionaries, we have to think about millions of people. How do we reach and talk to and engage hundreds and thousands and millions of people at a time? And that really then affects your understanding of strategy and tactics, because what I've come to learn is that most of the things that I know how to do actually don't really engage the necessary number of people, right? So part of my work and the work of my organization in the next phase is to really think about how we talk to, engage, and really have dialogue with way more people than for most of us, even those of us who've done this for a while, way more than we've ever known how to do, and that really speaks to the daily work. Another question that I think is really important is the question of, you know, if there's a movement, then who leads it? And who's central to it? And oftentimes the question of leadership is looked at by people as an individual question. Well, should it be Linda? Or should it be Carla? You know, and we don't really understand that question in that same way, right? Yes, there will need to be individuals who can play certain types of key roles, whether those are convening roles, those are kind of roles of like, you know, providing inspiration or thinking, but like I think really when we think about it, the question of leadership, I think it's really around whose participation is central and what sector and what group is really necessary to move forward this type of mass strategy, this type of mass movement, this type of mass organization. And for us, in my organization, and looking at Oakland specifically, you know, for example, it's really clear it's working class black folks in this city, right? And that is despite the fact that, you know, and this is the statistic, is that in the last 5 to 7 years, you know, the working class black population in Oakland has displaced about like 25 to 30%. I don't know if, you know, Alicia probably knows the figure. It's something worse in San Francisco, for example, right? But despite that systemic driving out of working class black folks in the city, there still has to be a clarity about if you wanted to, at a very local level, see the types of change we wanted to see, that one of the fundamental steps of that would be building up of that black working class base, right? Protecting those who are still here, and then expanding that the leadership of that group to beyond what it is currently. The other thing I wanted to talk about is this notion that we think of a lot, which is how we understand the how to do this work, which I think then ties in a little bit with the role of white folks, for example. In our work and in our model, we understand that there is an actual critical role for the organizer, right? There are many, many forms of building organization. There are many, many forms of building movements. There are many, many types of organizations. All that is true. and very important. The work that I do and the sector that I come out really is trying to think about building up organizations, and that organizers have a central role in that. We call this the practice of being a conscious organizer. We talk about this this work in terms of the role and the practice of the conscious organizer, and there's a couple of key components to this that I wanted to mention. So firstly, it's a clarity about who our base is, and the ability of folks who see themselves as conscious organizers, the practice of deep and daily engagement with that base, right? So what does that mean and what does that look like? I think leads to the second point, which is being extremely deeply grounded in the conditions of the of our base, right? So for us as a housing organization, it's literally the difference between knowing the difference of how the housing crisis is affecting people living in foreclosed homes, people in Section 8 housing, public housing residents, like that you have to actually block by block, building by building, person by person, you have to start to understand the differences between a public housing resident and a Section 8 tenant, but between East Oakland and West Oakland. You got to actually get to that level of deep understanding about what's affecting people and what's really, really happening to folks on the ground. Secondly, is this practice of being deeply grounded equally in political theory, movement history, movement thinking, and in day-to-day organizing practice, right? So the organizer as theorist, the theorist as an organizer, these things, they are one and the same. They're two sides of a coin, if you will, because in fact, you know, this is a push against the understanding that you can either think your way out of this oppressive system or out of empire, or you can just work every day and work as hard as you can, and that you know, there are a number of hours that you can work so hard that you can end this thing. It's neither of those things are true in our opinion, right? So hard work has to be based in some sense of towards what are you working, what are you working for, what are you building towards, what is your understanding of what has happened before, and where are you headed with these things. These are all really important. The other point I really wanted to mention is, you know, I want folks to just pay attention. I feel like I'm talking about this in a relatively authoritative way. I want to be really, really clear. Our work is extremely experimental. It's very developmental, and it's very, very much in formation. These are ideas. Now, the fact that, you know, a bunch of people are spending many, many hours a day engaging in these ideas and working and trying to engage with them, in no way takes away from the fact that these are still ideas. I mean, you know, in the same way that Linda says, you know, 20 years after the fact, we're still calling this the post-civil rights era. It might take a 40 or 50-year perspective on this thing to have a more clearer and a more elegant name, a way to describe it. Our work is the same. Our work is the same. It's going to take a couple of decades to be able to get the clarity around what were the real contributions and what the developments were. But why I wanted to mention that is exactly for the point that Linda was mentioning earlier, which is that we're in a period we're in a low period. We're in an ebb period right now. We're not in our winningest phase. And experimentation is necessary. Experimentation, engagement with ideas, like putting these ideas into practice is really, really key. It's going to take a lot of stumbling. I mean, there's been a lot of stumbling around in the dark, just talking, reflecting on my own work history. You know, there's going to be lots of stumbling around in the dark, and there needs probably to be a lot more before we really actually come to a place of greater clarity. But through all this work, I think we better position ourselves for really what is hopefully the next period and the next moment, where, you know, where both you have more and more folks who are conscious, folks who have thought about these ideas, folks whose revolutionary politics have really sharpened and strengthened, and at the same time, that more and more there are working class folks of color who are in that group, right? Because it's like, and this is the last thing I'll say about kind of the white folks questions of privilege, et cetera. You know, I mostly talk and speak to on a daily basis with organizers of color, many of whom mostly come from working class communities of color. The difference between them and the disconnect that they feel with our base is that for the most part, a lot of them have gone to college. And so folks engage with the question of what is my role very differently. There's oftentimes a very big push to say, you know, now that I've gone to college, does that make it not possible for me to go back home to my neighborhood? Is it possible for me to go back to, am I really, you know, do I really understand what's going on in East Oakland now? I spent those 4 years at UCLA and UCLA messed up my head and, you know, West Hollywood had a really bad influence on me. You know, and do I know enough, right? And I think that really for a lot of us, I think the question is how to use privilege and how to use the skills, the analysis, the thinking, the opportunities that for many of us have been provided by privilege. You know, whether that privilege be educational or, you know, race privilege, et cetera. I think like the real question is how do we use it to the purposes of building movement? And I think more specifically the question I'd put out is to support the development of working class leadership in this country. So if the answer is that you think you have what it takes to really want to try to get down with that, then I would say that there can and will be a role for many of us to play. So.
Hey, how y'all feeling? Good. Okay, so I'm gonna try not to repeat. It's hard, couple hard acts to follow. But what I do wanna do just really quickly is talk a little bit about what our strategy is in terms of how do we build working class power in communities in San Francisco. And try to use that strategy to kind of talk about some bigger questions that we've been grappling with as an organization. And then talk a little bit about what we think is the role of anti-racist white organizers, not just in organizations like ours, right, but what are the kind of concrete, tangible things that we feel like we need to be doing right now. And I say we, not you, because it's we. So quickly, POWER stands for People Organized to Win Employment Rights, and we talk about ourselves as a community building and a movement building institution, right? So what does that mean, right? That we organize folks of color in San Francisco, working class, low income folks of color, immigrant women, right? Families, tenants, and young people, right? To build a movement that we hope, right, will end poverty and oppression once and for all. We think we can do that tomorrow. I don't know about y'all. And in our organization, we have several kind of different types of organizing projects. We do many different types of approaches. But one thing I'll say is that we're also clear that door knocking is not gonna get us to the level of scale or impact that we need, right, to build what we're trying to build. We're clear about that. We're not gonna knock on a million doors and change the world, right? What we are gonna do, though, is we're gonna use door knocking, we're gonna use street outreach, we're gonna use our organization as vehicles, right? As vehicles to experiment and take risks and think about where are we trying to go and actually create the small level cells that we feel like we need to multiply across the country and across the world, right? And when I say that, it doesn't mean, well, we want to create little powers everywhere, right? No, we want to create vehicles that are self-determining, right? That match the conditions of where you are and what you need and that coordinate and integrate with other types of vehicles like POWER, or whatever it is that you choose to build, to actually move something forward, right? Okay, that's the broad stuff. So the three kind of components of our strategy that we see is necessary to build working class power in San Francisco and beyond is base building, right? We feel like obviously it's necessary to amass numbers of people that you can mobilize. Activate to take action on something, right? Or a set of things. We want to grow our numbers, we want to expand our reach, and we want to develop the foundation of the movements that we're trying to build. That's the role of base building for us. Then there's institution building and building organization, right? So part of that is using our organization as a vehicle and building what we're calling a collective political project, right? Which is an opportunity for our grassroots members, for our conscious organizers, right? Supporters, community members, people in our local area to help drive and shape what should our organization look like, what should it be doing, and how should we do it. And finally, it's movement building, right? So we don't just want to amass numbers, right? We want to win hearts and minds, and we want to use that to do something. So we want to activate, we want to coordinate, and we want to synchronize. Okay. So I'm a little nervous, that's all right. One thing I will say, though, is that this is a big part of my vision. I want to multiply the Catalyst Project and the Ann-Braden Program, and I tell Chris and Ingrid this all the time, everywhere. Rural areas, urban areas, every state, every city, so I say, let's get to it, right? In our base building work, we actually lead with the question of race. We think that in our communities, right, people are actually very aware that racism still exists. It's not a question, right? And we want to do that on several different levels. We want to do that in our door knocking. We want to do that in our campaigns. When we're talking to targets or when we're advancing demands, we're talking about race front and center all the time. We want to keep the question of race on the table at every moment because we understand that to really be the foundation, part of the foundation, right, a huge part of what we're trying to break apart, what we're trying to break open. When we say that we organize working class African Americans in San Francisco as a population of people that have dropped 50% almost in the last 15 years, we have to talk about race. Even if folks don't want to, we have to, right? It's about the survival of our folks, and it's about actually saying, no, we're not gone, right? We're still here, we have the right to be here, and we want to build communities that serve our needs, and we don't just want to kind of get by, right? We want to thrive, we deserve to thrive. Okay, so what does that look like, right? We have a Women Workers Project that organizes immigrant Latinas to take action in their workplaces, in their homes, and in their communities. We are currently running a racial profiling campaign that's about immigrant workers having documentation or not having documentation, getting pulled over by the San Francisco Police Department, and having your car impounded for not having a driver's license that you can't receive by federal law, right? But you still have to work, right? So we have been successful in coalition with other organizations in actually getting a new policy at the San Francisco Police Department that says that drivers without documents can call community members, family members that have documents so that you can avoid having your car taken away, so that you can continue to get to work, so that you can continue to feed your family, right? Is that the end-all be-all? No, right? But what has it done? It's encouraged community members to create what we're calling an emergency response network, right? Where we purchased a number of Metro phones. Everybody knows about Metro phones, right? No contract. And we're using those phones with different community members to be able to activate at a moment's notice if somebody is pulled over and they don't have documents and they're in danger of having their car impounded, that you can call somebody who will get you to somebody who has a driver's license and who has insurance and who can help within a 20-minute span of time, right, help keep you out of the surveillance of the San Francisco Police Department, at least for that moment, okay? And what does that do? It creates and continues to maintain and build community, which is critical, right? The ability for people to depend on one another, to activate one another, to politicize one another and say, hey, this isn't just about me having a driver's license or documents, right? But this is about calling the question, right? About your ability to get documents. It's about calling the question of the practice of the San Francisco Police Department in our neighborhoods. Right? It's about creating our own defense mechanisms that aren't militarized. Right? We're also building a base of working class African Americans in Bayview Hunters Point to fight for a community that challenges the legacy of environmental racism, but that also supports and nurtures low-income communities of color. Right? Folks may or may not know that Bayview Hunters Point is the site of one of the worst Superfund sites in the country. The Hunters Point Naval Shipyard is slated for luxury development. They're building high-rise condominiums on the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard, a site where there is radioactive materials buried underneath the ground, right? A site where 50% of people in the community suffer from cancer or some other kind of respiratory illness, right? And instead of saying we want to revitalize this area to make it useful for people who live in the community, they're saying we're not going to remove the toxics. We want to build as quickly as possible, right? So we see our role in that as galvanizing people who live in the community who are affected by that shipyard and by the toxicity of the shipyard and the toxicity of the policies of San Francisco to fight. And not just fight against, because we're all clear about what we don't want, right? But what we have to start to get clear about is what we do want. And that's been a question that has been pushing our organization for the last 12 years, but really doing this deep work in Bayview Hunters Point has pushed our sense of urgency in terms of not just fighting against global capitalism and imperialism, right? But we also have to start talking about what does that look like? And what are the small things that we can do to bring that forward so that we can hold the hearts and minds of the folks that we need to the most, right? Which, in our opinion, is a working class community of color base, but it's a multi-class front, right? When we look in a neighborhood like Bayview Hunters Point, it's not just low-income folks who live there, and quite frankly, the neighborhood is changing as we speak, right? So our strategy has to involve middle-class folks, right? In fact, some of our base who are homeowners, right? They are straddling that line. We have to be able to talk about in a really sharp way, what does that front look like? What is our class strategy, right? Race and class and gender. Cool. Institution building, right? And building organization. So what we are trying to do is create dynamic spaces within our organization to be able to increase learning, cooperation, and support. We're trying to be intentional about how we build, about what we build, and trying to develop collective ownership to be able to build that collective political project, right? We want our members to see power as their political home, as a place where they can grow ideas, as a place where they can grow alternatives. That is critical, right? We want people in our communities to know who we are and what we do, and why the little stuff that we do on a day-to-day basis, right, is better than the crap that we get every day. Okay. One of the things that we've started to do in our process of building organization and building an institution is we've started to integrate this frame of ecological justice, right, and starting to think about, well, if we know, right, that the planet is in a bad place, if we know that people are a huge part of why the planet is in a bad place, right, then how do we integrate that when we're talking about racial justice and environmental justice and economic justice and gender justice, right? So one of the things that we've started to do is talk about and integrate ecology into our organization. Not just as the relationships between plants and animals and organisms, right, but also people, right? And starting to think about how do we grow healthy relationships, just like we grow broccoli and kale, right? And how do we do that in a way that brings together communities of color that have been divided by simple wedge issues, like jobs, right? Or just like misunderstandings and stereotypes about who one another is, right? Or like competition. How do we actually grow the kinds of relationships that we want to proliferate? Okay. So to do that, right, we started a black-brown victory garden on our roof in the mission, right? And it's been great to grow broccoli and kale and chards and all that, but it's been even better, right, to see a dialogue happening between immigrant Latinas and African Americans and young people and being able to bring that history of, here's where I come from. Here's what food means to me. which sparks other conversations, right? Which is what we're trying to do, right? And it doesn't directly fit into an organizing project, right? We're not thinking gardens are the end of the, of, you know, what liberation is, but it does remind us to keep growing our vision, right? And then finally, movement building. We've been experimenting with a lot of different types of movement building, both locally, right, on a statewide level, and then nationally. So quickly, I can talk about the work that we've been doing in Bayview Hunters Point to build a multi-class, interdenominational alliance to fight for the community, right? Which includes figures like the Nation of Islam, pastors of all different denominations, right? The Samoan and Tongan community in Bayview Hunters Point, right? Environmental organizations, both more progressive and more mainstream, right? And starting to have dialogues and conversations with forces that we probably never would have before, right? Statewide, we're doing similar types of coalitions like the Domestic Workers Alliance, which just had their Congress here in Oakland. And then nationally, of course, the Rights of the City Alliance and the U.S. Social Forum, which I hope folks know is coming up in Detroit, June the 22nd through the 26th. We want to have a larger conversation about that. That could maybe be another session. So winning hearts and minds, building hearts and minds, growing hearts and minds, trying to experiment and take risks and be bold enough to try new things and push a little more to the left, right? When we talk about the question of what are we trying to build, bigger picture, for us, we're trying to build vibrant, resilient, multifaceted, multi-class, multiracial movements that inspire, that empower, and that cultivate the new worlds that we are bringing forward. And I say worlds, right, because we believe we need to build a world where many worlds can fit, okay? That while it's important, right, for us to struggle with this question of leadership, right, it's important for us to cultivate leadership where it grows and allow that to proliferate, right? And the question of how do we move millions of people, right? Countering the hegemony of fear and hate, right? It was so important that you brought up the right wing and how they're able to talk about race without talking about race, right? By capitalizing on the fear and the hate that they cultivate. We want to counter that with love. Sounds simple, sounds easy, right? Sounds maybe cheesy, but that's what we're trying to do. That's what we see as transformative, right? Because it's really easy for us to be like, and we hate those right wing, and we hate those, and we hate, we do, we don't like, right? There's plenty of that. There's plenty of that in the world. What do we love? How do we show it? How do we push our vision of love? Because what are we trying to build, right? Are we trying to just tip it to the other way? Or are we trying to smash the whole thing apart? And when we smash the whole thing apart, what does it look like? What are the seeds? What are the seeds that grow from the rubble? So, in closing, I will say that I think the question of solidarity and action is extremely important. We're grateful for our Ann Braden interns. We love them. We love you. We love you. Like I would say to Drew, put some shine on it, right? Our organizers are organizing out in the community alongside our base, right? We don't see a division. We think, in fact, over the long term, we'd like to build in our organization an anti-racist organizer, right? That's going out and talking to white folks who are involved in these development projects, who are moving in because it's cheap, right? Moving in because it's the last place that they can afford. We want to engage in that conversation. Right? So we want to thank the Catalyst Project and the Ann Braden Program for pushing our thinking. Right? We want to thank you for giving us Drew and Charlie and everybody, right, over the years, Carl and Thomas and Alex, hallelujah. And we want to thank you for being committed enough, right, to continue to do this work and to continue to struggle with the questions you're struggling with, and we look forward to struggling with you. Thank you.
All right, good afternoon. It really means a lot to me to be part of this Catalyst program, and just really excited to what I consider the growing Catalyst community and the wonderful panel. I feel, you know, it's just inspiring, and I feel like for me, you know, the work, how to do anti-racism work, it connected to transformative change has been my heart's work, and I think we absolutely have to talk about love, and it's exciting to see other people being with their hearts in that. I was going to talk about a fairness campaign and our work to do LGBT work from an anti-racist perspective in an intentional way that moves us beyond acting as individuals, but working together to do that. I was born into a family of race and class privilege. Anne Braden said over and over again, she said, as a white Southern woman who grew up in privilege, she said, it's a prison we're born into. She said, as a white woman in a racist society, that's a prison. And as a woman with economic privilege, that's a prison. Because for her, her own liberation was connected to having to be actively engaged in the struggle against racism. And a big chunk of that work was done from the home base of Kentucky, a Bible Belt state, a southern border state, a state that gave its native son, Abraham Lincoln, only 1,500 votes, and the first state to turn red, the bad kind of red, in last year's election, you know, when you're watching the map and there pops up Kentucky. It was also the state where Anne Braden and her husband were charged with sedition, attempt to overthrow the state of Kentucky for helping a black family buy a home in a white neighborhood. My parents were active in the civil rights and anti-war movement, and so I learned fairly early that my family had much more than we needed and too many people didn't have enough. I met Anne Braden as a child, and it was her passionate expression about the work that she did that felt to me as a child like the hope part in a world that seemed set up all wrong. I was a lot of years into full-time organizing from Free the Wilmington 10, anti-apartheid organizing, affordable housing, runaway shop, living wage struggles, international solidarity, and voting rights work when I first carried a bullhorn to chant racism, sexism, we say no, homophobia's got to go. I was barely out to myself, not out to my family, and I was on the board of the Kentucky Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, and we were working to expose the fact that too many of the Louisville police force were also members of the Klan. In those conversations, you know, all those years ago with Anne Braden, Bob Cunningham, other civil rights leaders, we talked a lot about how do we engage more white people in the struggle against racism. Not in the abstract, but in the context of working for change. We saw that historically and in the organizing, over and over again, it was racism that divided people that should have been standing together, and that whether it was police abuse or economic injustice or any kind of oppression, that nobody was going to make any progress on any issue unless we dealt squarely with the issue of racism. And a core of us who were coming out of that perspective began planning the Fairness Campaign out of our anti-racism organizing. We believe that organizing for LGBT rights, at least in Louisville, could and needed to be done differently from the politics of privilege that we saw dominating too many equality efforts around the country. We believed that fairness, the work for fairness, should not only expand the rights of LGBT people, as critical as that was, but that it should broaden the base of anti-racism efforts as well, and that indeed LGBT rights could not really be won unless anti-racism work was central to it. The potential for this kind of organizing came, had a test for us in the early 90s. This was just as we were thinking about launching the Fairness Campaign. And it was around a battle for a hate crimes ordinance in response to the firebombing of a black family's home. The black-led coalition of supporters of this legislation decided to have sexual orientation included in the law. And the same white, far-right folks who had anchored anti-abortion work in the 70s unleashed this just, you know, huge explosion of homophobia. The liberals ran for cover, and the conservatives demanded that the gays be taken out of the legislation if it was going to pass. And unlike other places where too many LGBT folks are not grounded in those the trenches work with people of color activists and with anti-racist struggles, a coalition like that could fall apart. And yet in Louisville it held. And with that experience, we decided, you know, the time was right to launch an all-out movement-building effort around LGBT rights with these main three goals. We wanted to win basic job, housing, and public accommodation protections. Queer people had no rights whatsoever in the state of Kentucky, and certainly not in Louisville. Secondly, we wanted to neutralize homophobia as a weapon of division. And third, we wanted to establish Louisville's LGBT movement as a reliable partner in broader peace and justice efforts, but in particular, a partner in the anti-racist struggle. The political atmosphere during that time was abysmal. With rare exceptions, no one was winning anything anywhere. It was framed by the war in Iraq, welfare reform, the gays in the military failure, Defense of Marriage Act, equal rights, not special rights, which was the banner of the right wing. The Democratic Party under Clinton was tacking to the right, and progressives were largely sidelined. Around the country, the right wing's recruitment numbers were going up, and they were exploiting homophobia within marginalized communities and racism within gay organizing to advance this agenda for racism, war, tax cuts for the rich, etc. And the white-led LGBT groups around the country, due to the racism within the movement, the class bigotry, the lack of genuine relations with communities of color, were vulnerable to this attack. And all over, homophobia was dividing folks again that should be standing together. Locally, the liberal elected officials were telling us, you can't do this, go away, you're gonna stir up the right wing. You're going to make things worse, and we thank them for their counsel and moved on. In the years that followed, eventually thousands of people would participate in public protest, letter writing, lobbying, 24-hour vigils, hearings at City Hall that sometimes went on for 6 hours. Against opponents who were claiming that the issue really came down to the safety of children and perverts who had sex with animals. That was pretty much their main line. But we continued to go door to door, talking with voters about fairness, people who were newly out, And never before politically got arrested in civil disobedience actions. And over again, we forced the city council to vote on the law, even though we knew we were not going to win. Because all of it, including the losses, brought us back stronger, encouraged more people to step forward, and deepened the understanding that winning, as much as the law was important, was much bigger than that and had to be. And after almost 15 years of organizing, we were able to pass the most progressive and inclusive law, one of the most progressive inclusive laws of its kind in the country, covering both sexual orientation and gender identity, something that many cities far bigger and much less conservative than Louisville had yet to achieve. And you know, you could look at that and say, oh, well, that's a good, you know, kind of civic lesson, and you know, how do you get political change to happen? But there's another story that I think is much more important to our movement building, and that's that in Louisville, we wanted, and however imperfectly, have tried to do the work in a way that anchors the LGBT struggle in an inclusive vision of justice with anti-racism at its core. And we did this in a city that's considered, with, you know, not meant for you all, but with too many of our sisters and brothers on the East or West Coast would say, you know, you can't, you know, that's not possible, and Louisville's the backward. We always used to get asked why we weren't moving to San Francisco. Yeah. Around the country, there are groups doing really critical queer work from an intersectional perspective. But because of racism, class, and gender discrimination, and split alliances on the part of a lot of, within the queer community, intersectional politics are still not the dominant expression of LGBT power. Nationally and on the ground in most places, racism works to keep POC LGBT people marginalized and intersectional politics marginalized. With few exceptions, white LGBT organizations and individuals with power rarely use that power for movement building that challenges racism or moves beyond identity politics. With important exceptions, LGBT work is not about becoming part of an anti-racism struggle with a common agenda to expand democracy for all. Such failures hold us all back, and I think the Prop 8 experience here really is a glaring example of that. Many predominantly white LGBT groups will say, oh yes, our group is for racial justice too. But we learn the hard way that putting that into practice is another challenge altogether. And the on-again, off-again efforts fade when they're countered to so-called reality politics or staying focused on our issues, or as in the case of the marriage campaigns, you know, this idea of winning. In the fairness work, we have these challenges, and I know we'll continue to have them. Very imperfectly, though, we've tried to create a space to do things differently. And as a result, relationships across lines of difference between individuals and groups previously rare or considered impossible have been born. Power built for an inclusive justice agenda and creating opportunities to leverage fairness political clout for, among other things, living wage, police reform, and where the Democratic Party is dominated by blue dog incumbents, progressives, and especially progressives of color winning electoral office. In almost 30 years of peace and justice work, I've come to believe that nothing changes our world politically and personally as much as where we put our bodies. And in fairness, we try to create situations for this to happen. And it happens when we're standing on a picket line for minority contracts over and over again as part of the fairness work at 7 o'clock in the morning with somebody who does not look like us. It's when brown, black, and white lesbians get arrested protesting police abuse together with the black minister and the mother whose son was stomped to death by the city jailers. It happens when in all our queerness we've joined United Fight food and commercial workers outside the Fisher packing plant or flyer the gay bars that are hosting the white comedian in blackface, Shirley Q. Liquor. It happens when we lobby with former felons for voter restoration and when we go door to door talking not only about fairness, LGBT rights, but also for a living wage and against police abuse. And it happens when we keep showing up for someone who may not trust us yet or move over or step back because we're all lifted higher and stronger when the room represents the full diversity of our community. We've had the attacks from within the LGBT community and other allies of privilege. When we launched an economic protest of Kentucky Fried Chicken because of its lack of minority hiring and franchising, national LGBT groups weighed in and told us, didn't we realize that sexual orientation was in Kentucky Fried Chicken's employment policy, so why were we out there on the picket line with our sisters and brothers of color? During the presidential primaries last year, when Clinton was making the unabashed appeals to racism among Democratic voters and party leaders, a local battle broke out in Louisville because we were supporting a longtime black supporter of LGBT rights, a straight man, against a white gay founder of Fairness. Fairness was was challenged for not supporting the interests of gay men, of white gay men. And if Fairness were one of several groups in town doing the political work, it probably would be easier for folks to marginalize us, but Fairness remains the main group in town. So it means that when white folk are getting involved in LGBT work, they are moving into a framework of doing the work from an intersectional place, and a lot of folks who are queer who are coming out, it's like their first political work. So it, from the beginning, that's how folks learn how to do the work. There are LGBT folk and allies who support us because of our inclusive justice vision, but there are also those who do it despite that. There are white folks who will tell you, in fairness, who will tell you that the racial and economic justice work made them uncomfortable and didn't seem gay enough, but they also have to look at that it's been effective work. It's built power and it's won stuff for gay people. We've brought political power together with winning concrete changes, and that will keep a lot of people in the room for the time it takes to get people to understand the importance of doing the work this way on a deeper level. James Baldwin wrote, "If you can't be touched, you can't be changed, and if you can't be changed, you can't be alive." We found that when we create opportunities for this to happen, we can actually change the world. Thank you.
So how many people learned something right now? How many people are feeling inspired? Okay, so show some more love then.
All right, y'all, we're about to do something to help build some power. So first, I would invite you all who are able to stand up or lift your arms up towards vision. Stand up. Get those arms going. And from what I can see from the back room, this panel was smoking hot. So that vision is smoky, and we got to get it out of our vision because it is hot, but we got to see what we're looking for at the same time. And this panel is smoking hot. And as we were hearing about grassroots power and organizing, we got to go down to the grassroots. So come on down, bend on down.
Okay.
Feel those muscles in your legs. And then come on back up and just move around, because we got to build movement, and that means motion. So just move your ass, move your body, and get a groove. So as part of this panel, we also want to provide concrete support for grassroots organizing to do many of the things that were talked about on this panel. And so before you sit down, I want to invite you to lean on back and pull out your wallets. Because we're going to do something here with together. So pull out those wallets, get your checkbooks out. Because concretely, today, we're going to raise between $400 to $600 for the Right to the City Alliance, which is the national alliance that was talked about on the panel, of over 40 grassroots organizations around the country working to build power in working class communities, communities of color, with a justice agenda, justice, an urban justice, anti-gentrification agenda, with a rural justice agenda, with a vision of indigenous self-determination agenda, and with a when working class folks of color are at the center of the movement, as we were talking about today, we can create liberatory space that frees all of us. So we're going to raise between $400 to $600 together today. Y'all feel that?
Yeah.
You think we can do that? You think we can do that? So if one were to make out a check, I bet someone knows who they would make it out to. Right to the city. So that's where the check goes to. In the cash, we were talking earlier about love. Right now, we want you to put in love bucks. And so what we mean by that is to pull out your money and to seriously think about the people in your lives who you want to see them experience freedom. Whether that's people, your nephews, your nieces, your kids, your grandparents, the person down the street, to pull out some money and to think about the people who you want to see free. And put some love bucks in these boxes, because we're going to raise at least $600 today, I think. Right to the city. So right to the city. So remember, each dollar, each check, each $20, each $100 check is about concretely building the power of our movements to advance the justice agenda that we are hearing about on this panel. And so one more time, if you felt some serious motivation in your heart leaning towards freedom, I want you to give some love to this panelist. So let's raise some money, let's keep building power. And now we're going to move into some Q&A here. But seriously, we're going to bust 600. We'll give you an update later. We got to bust this stuff, because we got too much love in this room for those boxes to only hold 400.
Are we on time? Okay. Okay, so what we're going to do right now is we're going to take just a couple minutes for you to take all this awesome knowledge and inspiration and just take a couple minutes to talk to somebody near you, maybe meet somebody you don't know, introduce yourself, and just talk about, you know, what stood out for you and if you have questions. And then we're just going to take a couple minutes, and then we're going to have some chance to talk with the panelists. So I'll let you know when it's time to come back.
Maybe.
Thank you. week.
Okay, everyone, if we can come back to the large group. Okay, everyone, welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. So we only have a little bit of time left together, and we wanted a chance for people to ask some questions. So what I'm going to do is just take a couple questions, and then we'll get a chance to hear from the panelists, and then we're going to close out. So does anyone have a question that they would like to ask or comment also?
For Carla, the legislation that you were talking about passing that eventually included the sexual orientation, along with other things, was, I think that I remember reading it in the bio that was a hate crime law. Is that what it was? Yeah. Okay, I guess it says here, Carla helped coordinate efforts to pass Louisville's hate crimes law. Was that something, a separate story, or?
That was a struggle pre-fairness that was led by out of the black community that we were supporting.
Any other questions?
First of all, thank you so much for this panel. This was so amazing and exciting, and I teared up a few times. It was absolutely lovely to hear such a diversity of experiences and generationally. And so my question is for Dawn and Alicia around scale, because both of you talked about wanting to reach larger numbers of folks. And I'm wondering what some of your strategies and tactics are on that.
My question is kind of a question as well as a statement. I'm African American. I feel more American than anything else. And really, as a young person, I feel like the problem with racism is the race. I feel I'm a human being because I bleed, I feel, I love, I hurt, just like any other person. So my question to everyone in this room as well as the panelists would be, do you think the key to eliminating racism is eliminating race? Because we're all humans. It's just we come from different parts of the planet and we have different color skin. That is the only difference. So my question is, do you guys agree with that? And if you do, what steps can we take to make that a reality? Because if everyone just looked at each other as a person, we wouldn't have racism, we wouldn't have prejudice. Lesbians and gays wouldn't have issues with other people because they're people who love and feel and hurt and, you know, have dreams and aspire to do better. So I just wanted to ask, what would you guys say about that, and what are some steps we can do to in our organizing to make that a reality?
I'm sorry, I got scared for a second and wasn't prepared. But I guess my question is, we've been doing a lot of like learning around the prison industrial complex and policing and things like that, and I'm just starting to learn a little bit about hate crime laws and how, you know, especially that are being pushed around queer issues and transgender issues. And so I'm wondering, you know, both for you as someone who's worked on that kind of stuff and anyone else on the panel, like how to, you know, understand that those are things that are then increasing policing and increasing criminalization, and just kind of what are your thoughts on that, and how to, I don't know how to feel about it.
Sure. Okie doke, is this on?
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, so tactics and strategies around how to build to scale. One of the things that we're experimenting with right now is the electoral vehicle. And we had some experience doing that in 2008 in San Francisco, where we put our own ballot initiative to San Francisco voters about what development should look like in Bayview Hunters Point. And I guess there's a couple like lessons I think that we learned from that. One, it's an opportunity to kind of challenge us as organizations that have kind of a left framework around how do you talk to people that don't have that, right? And also it comes with an assessment of like what is it that we, what's the fight that's happening right now? And part of what we're seeing across the country is like a fight for the middle, right? And we don't necessarily think that door knocking is just gonna do that. We're not gonna win the middle through door knocking, right? But what we can do is use an electoral vehicle as an opportunity to have broader conversations about what we think democracy looks like, how we want to shape our communities, who we want to shape our communities and why. And it gives us an opportunity to have a larger grouping of people that we get to test out. Can we move those people to do something? Right? Even if it's as basic as